Hello, students, and welcome to Class of X, the free internet course on how to read and enjoy the X-Men comics better. I'm your teacher and host, John Reisinger, and today we're going to talk about a villain that, thanks to the cartoon X-Men 97, everyone is talking about and now knows about. It's time, I think, that we had a chat about Bastion. That's right, we're going to have a little bit of a character deep dive and a history lesson today, but welcome back to the show. Hi, I'm John, if you're new here. I'm a comic book reader for the last three decades. I'm a huge X-Men nerd, and I have made this show in order to try to convince people to convert their interest or even admiration of the X-Men into possibly even checking out the comics and reading their stories, because now's a better time than ever to go back and read through good old 80s and 90s X-Men, because X-Men 97, the new Disney Plus series, is just pulling stories right and left from the X-Men through the decades. I say 80s and 90s, but we're even getting stuff from the 2000s now. And while I think they're doing a fantastic job kind of mishmashing and messing with these stories as they please, I love to let people know and inform people about the history of these stories and give you a little bit of context about what's going on and give you a little bit of a behind the scenes of who these characters and places and stories are. Just to either pick your interest or give you something to talk about at your next cocktail party. That's what people do at cocktail parties, right? They talk about X-Men and comics. That's what I do, at the very least, assuming I even go to cocktail parties and not just sit at home all the time reading X-Men comics and playing Stardew Valley. But thanks again for being here, and I want to talk about a character that we have actually touched on a few times in previous episodes, Bastion, who's a big baddie in this season of X-Men 97, but we've never fully gone over his real origin story from the comics, which is wildly different from the cartoon, and I'm not going to say which one I think is better. I'm just going to tell you this is what Bastion comes from in the comics, and there's a reason why it has to be wildly different. The ingredients needed for Bastion's origin story in Marvel Comics, according to Earth 616, their canonical universe, there's stuff that's there that the cartoons have either already messed with too much or just isn't there yet. And so the writers obviously had to come up with a new origin story. But I think it's interesting to hear about where Bastion comes from in the comics, and also to hear about his rather large, important crossover event, which they're playing with right now in the cartoon, that being Operation Zero Tolerance. But too much hemming and hawing. We're going to talk about Bastion. I'm also going to give you a little bit of a history lesson of the island Genosha, because I feel like that's also pertinent. Genosha is a big part of this season of X-Men 97, and we've never gone over all of the history of it. And I'm not going to go over all the history. I'm going to give you a brief summary. And then I want to finish up the episode with a fun little segment for you where, while we are at episode 8 of X-Men 97, as of recording of this podcast, and we got two more episodes to go of their three-part finale, I'm going to call my shot and say what I think is going to be the stinger, or a possible stinger, at the end of the season that's going to lead into their second season. The show has been greenlit for three seasons so far, and they're doing a fantastic job getting so much due praise for how well the show is doing. I think I can see where they're taking this. I think I'm seeing the Matrix. But before I get to that, again, let's talk about Bastion, a character created by Mark Waid and Andy Kubert. Dates all the way back to the 80s and 90s, but his actual origin starts in the 60s, all the way to the beginning of the X-Men's history, with the beginning of the Sentinels. Sentinels are a villain and a character that everyone knows of. They're quite prominently used in a lot of X-Men media. They were in the very beginning of the X-Men 90s cartoon. They abscond and harass Jubilee at a mall, and the X-Men with Storm and Rogue and Cyclops fight those Sentinels right off the get-go. So we know what those giant purple robots look like, but I don't think very many people actually know the history of the Sentinels, and so here it is, a little bit of a history lesson of the Sentinels, to give you a history lesson of Bastion. The Sentinels go all the way back to X-Men, I think it's 14 or 15, and they were a robot created by Bolivar Trask. We know Bolivar Trask. He's shown up in the cartoon. He's a nasty human scientist who, you know, uses his extreme intellect and bigotry to create a robot that is meant to hunt and kill mutants. The Mark One was his first one that he made, and they were facilitated by his creation of the Master Mold. The Master Mold was a larger daddy sentinel. That was in charge of facilitating the building and programming of the Sentinels. The Mark Ones were basically human size. They weren't these giant behemoth robots, but they always had that iconic looking head and purple coloring. Although they did have some other coloring as well, they were the beginning of this, and they were kind of bumbling robots that were eventually easily defeated. And in fact, it was Bolivar Trask who assisted in their defeat, because the Master Mold, as is common with these AI stories, decided it knew better about how to keep the humans safe, and it thought the best way to keep them safe was to be in charge and get rid of the governments and even a lot of humans in the first place. Because where do mutants come from? They come from humans. So how do you stop mutants? Well, you stop humans. Or how do you stop mutants? You stop humans. And so that was the Mark One, Bolivar Trask, and he actually sacrificed himself, his life, in order to destroy that initial Master Mold. Enter his Nepo baby, nasty son, Larry Trask, who develops the Mark II. These appeared in X-Men 57 back in 1969. And these were the first Sentinels that were able to adapt to mutants that they encounter. This is the Sentinel that everyone kind of thinks of when they think of Sentinel. It's the giant robots with the metal tendrils that come out of their palms, or the hot steam and knockout gas that comes out of their fingertips. These are the Sentinels that kind of, you know, scan the mutants, figure out what they are, and then have some sort of countermeasure. They didn't have perfect countermeasures for everything, and they were an excuse for writers to let the X-Men cut loose and destroy something. But Larry Trask was the one who created them back in 1969. We're going to jump forward to X-Men number 100. This is where we're going to meet a guy named Stephen Lang. He's another scientist who develops another generation of Sentinel, the third generation of Sentinels. But because these were based off of incomplete notes, the third generation Sentinels weren't very good, but his true opus was the creation of the X-Sentinel. The X-Sentinel was a kind of like a life model decoy from S.H.I.E.L.D. if you read those comics or remember them from the MCU. They were copies, robotic copies of the original X-Men, and they fought the X-Men. And they were discovered to be robots and defeated by an enraged Wolverine who was fighting a robot Jean Grey, who was being so mean to him. And she was being mean to him in a way that Jean would never be mean to Wolverine. And so he was able to kind of tap into his like berserker rage and like rip out her robotic chest and reveal that the X-Sentinels are these false X-Men are robots, and they fought them. Stephen Lang also was working with a Master Mold, and in the end of the fight between Stephen Lang and his Sentinels and the X-Men in space, Stephen Lang actually accidentally merged his mind with that Master Mold. This is actually the issue, X-Men 100, where the X-Men are fleeing like this seemingly destroyed base and destroyed Master Mold in a spaceship. And this is the issue where, upon entry into the atmosphere, the spaceship doesn't seem to have the right paneling and protection to keep the X-Men safe from the radiation when you enter Earth's atmosphere. And so Jean quarantines them in like the back of the ship that I guess has enough protection, but someone needs to stay in the front to pilot the ship. And so she sacrifices herself, and this is when she comes in contact with the Phoenix. And this is the beginning of the Phoenix saga. So a lot happening in X-Men 100, which you would understand to be a big event for them to do, to be the 100th issue. And X-Men 100 is the beginning of where we're going to get lead all the way to Bastion, because this master mold that the X-Men think that they defeat just won't die. It has self-repair like programming, and that will constantly be a thorn in their side. So this master mold, now with the thoughts and memories of Stephen Lang, thinks it's a human. And has kind of like this false identity, but it makes a mistake. It tries to capture Angel and Iceman, but it also accidentally captures a Hulk. And I don't know if you guys know much about Hulk and robots, but they don't mix very well. Hulk just does what Hulk does and destroys the ship. The Angel and Iceman are able to escape, and the ship actually plummets to the Earth. But again, the master mold isn't dead, because if a writer wants something to not be dead in comics, you can always find a way. The change that happens to his master mold is that, I guess, upon entry into the Earth's atmosphere, it burns out most of its like Stephen Lang personality. So now it's back to like full on thought, heartless robot. And it thinks that it needs to repair itself and continue its programming of defeating mutants. It actually has this fight with like Cyclops in Alaska, and he defeats it. But then it makes its way to New York, where most comic book villains find their way to. And it kind of has a fight with Franklin Richards, who it deems as a threat because it's going to become... Franklin is a mutant still at this time. Spoiler, he's no longer considered a mutant. It's kind of the reveal of Franklin Richards not being a mutant is probably one of my least favorite parts of the Krakoan era. It was written in a four-part X-Men versus Fantastic Four title, and I don't think that was actually originally the result. I don't think it was the intent of like Jonathan Hickman's plan. I can't remember the writer who did X-Men versus Fantastic Four or X-Men and Fantastic Four, but they basically made it so that Franklin wants to go to Krakoa because he's a mutant. His dad doesn't want him to go to Krakoa because Reed Richards is kind of a butt a lot of times. But it's finally revealed that he doesn't need to go to Krakoa because he's not really a mutant. He used his omnipotent powers to make himself a mutant, so therefore he's not a true mutant. It's kind of lame. I don't really like it. But we go back. We're back in the. I think we're like in the 80s now at this point, where Franklin Richards is still a mutant and part of a team, a kids team called Power Pack. Power Pack. How do you describe Power Pack? It's like, you guys ever seen the movie Three Ninjas Kick Back or Fight Back? Kick Back, Fight Back? Can't remember. Take that movie and give them superpowers. That's what Power Pack is kind of like. It's just a bunch of superpowered kids fighting and doing... it was a title for Marvel to create to try to get even younger kids to read their comics. Anyways, they defeat Master Mold and kind of almost completely destroy it. But like I keep saying, it survives as like a single piece of like circuitry that is just kind of lost in this rubble in New York City. And so it's there and waiting, or we don't know it is there and waiting until we meet one of my favorite friends ever, Nimrod. I won't go into the whole history of Nimrod since we have a whole episode on him. I love that pink, adorable robot. He's fantastic. I'm going to give my review of what's going on at X-Men right now. I love what they did at the beginning of the Krakoan era with Nimrod. I don't think they know what they want to do with Nimrod at the end, now that we're doing Rise of the Powers of X and Fall of the House of X. And I don't really like what they're doing with Nimrod at the end here, which makes me very sad because I love this silly robot. He was sent from the future like a Terminator. He was sent here to defeat not John Connors, but Rachel Summers, who was deemed an Omega level mutant and had escaped from her timeline, which was the Days of Future Past timeline. He follows her through the timeline in Uncanny X-Men 191 in 1985. When he gets to New York City of the 1980s, he assumes a human identity. It's kind of cute. His name is Nicholas Hunter, which is a reference to his Nimrod name. Nimrod comes from a biblical character who was called the Great Hunter. So Nicholas Hunter, by night, fights criminals and mutants, and by day, works a day job for some reason. I don't know why he thought he needed to work a day job. He was living with humans, so maybe he thought, I'll hang with the humans and I'll also work with them. And so he was like a foreman on a construction site. And so it was on one of these construction sites that he stumbles upon this piece of circuitry from the master mold, and a whoopsies happens, and the master mold AI merges with Nimrod and actually for some reason takes over Nimrod and kind of usurps his programming and then begins to fully rebuild itself using the advanced Nimrod technology, because Nimrod's from the future. He's super advanced. He's a version of the Sentinel that can fully adapt to defeat any mutant. It seems to be the only way to defeat Nimrod is to overwhelm it with too many different super powerful mutant powers. The first time Nimrod is defeated is when Rogue basically takes all the powers of the X-Men all at once and fights him with like Nightcrawler's teleportation and Colossus's metal skin and all that kind of stuff. And so using this like advanced technology, the master mold takes over and rebuilds itself from all the stuff around the construction site. The X-Men have to fight it. This is happening all the way in X-Men 247 in 1989. They defeat that master mold kind of a two-part way. Nimrod kind of is able to get back its control for a moment. And then Dazzler sends it through the Siege Perilous. The Siege Perilous is one of the most absurd things that Claremont wrote into the X-Men in the 80s, but also one of the most important things for the X-Men in the 80s that I don't think any other media has ever touched on. I don't think the Siege Perilous showed up in the original X-Men cartoon. It's definitely not shown up in the movies. And so I understand why the Siege Perilous is not part of Bastion's origin story in X-Men 97, because it's this weird artifact given by a character named Roma, who is the Omniversal Magistrix, who basically is this super all-powerful... Is Roma? Roma is, I think, the daughter of Merlin. I forget all the lore sometimes about Otherworld and Luna Saturnine and Captain Braddock. It's a lot to keep track of. We won't go into all of that. You don't need to know everything about this. It sounds a little bit like Neverending Story and Stardust and Lord of the Rings and all that kind of stuff. But it's a artifact that all who enter the portal of the Siege Perilous, they're judged by what is quoted as the highest of powers, and then they're kind of given a chance of reincarnation and rebirth at that point, depending on how these powers judge them. Again, I'm pretty sure at this point you could be like, yeah, this is pretty silly, and I can understand why the cartoon did not want to try to make this a thing. I love it, though. It's Claremont being super absurd at the time. But this is 1989. The master mold that has been merged with Nimrod goes through the Siege Perilous along with Rogue. And Rogue eventually comes out, and she's actually got her brain fixed from the like multiple personality disorder that she gets from her powers and the whole thing where she fully absorbed Captain Marvel's powers and everything like that permanently. This is kind of one of those moments where Rogue gets like fixed every once in a while, and then she gets broken again because her powers are out of control and kind of suck for her. And this is one of those instances where she gets kind of back to normal again. But we don't know what happened to the Master Mold. We don't know for like 7 years until Uncanny X-Men 333, we get the first full appearance of this mysterious character named Bastion. Bastion is, in fact, the reborn hybrid of the Master Mold and Nimrod that went through the Siege Perilous. It actually judges him and then has him reborn as a full-grown, white-haired, sort of pink-skinned human sentinel hybrid dude who is found by a woman. He's like amnesiac and confused, and he's raised by this woman. He's found and nursed by Rose Gilberti, and Rose kind of does the nurse kind of thing, and he loves her so much for taking care of him that he takes her name, and he's named Sebastian Gilberti, which is shortened to Bastion. And he isn't initially a mutant hater, but he sees all of the... He's basically watching a bunch of Fox News and sees all the anti-mutant rhetoric and goes, yeah, I don't like mutants either. And it's kind of his sentinel programming coming back into play. And so he tries to, you know, through this radicalization, he tries to take part in anti-mutant sentiment, but he doesn't really have anything to offer because he's just a dude at this point who doesn't really fully understand what's going on. But he does meet up with Graydon Creed, who is the number one mutant-hating bigot of the 90s. He's the son of Mystique and Sabretooth, the human son, who was put up for adoption by them for what he considers being an inconvenience to them, which basically gives him all the fuel he needs to hate mutants forever. If your dad's Sabretooth, I don't think I can knock you for hating mutants. He's kind of the worst mutant ever. He is the most irredeemable mutant of all the X-Men history, to the point where even in the Krakoan era, he's just put in prison immediately, like forever prison. And so he hates mutants. And so he's the one who's like, he creates the Friends of Humanity, which are this like anti-mutant, like, you know, terrorist group. And so Bastion meets up with him and somehow unlocks his memories of advanced Sentinel technology, because he's got the Nimrod stuff inside of him, and he builds advanced Sentinels that are beyond the technology available of the present day time. And that's where we get the Prime Sentinels, that are these like sleeper cell Sentinels that are activated and are super advanced and hard for mutants to defeat. One of the big differences in the comics is that it's kind of portrayed that people don't know that they're Prime Sentinels, that they're like sleeper agents. They're kind of like, they didn't sign up for it. Although I guess that might've been the case in the cartoon as well. Anyways, this is where Bastion meets up with Graydon, and this is where Operation Zero Tolerance comes into play, and Bastion, you know, collaborates with the American government to deal with this pesky mutant problem. You can tell again, that would have been a lot to adapt into a cartoon, hence why they changed it completely. I'm okay with the changes. I love the portrayal of Bastion in the cartoon. The great thing about, you know, visual media like the cartoons or the movies is that you get to finally see these performances, you know, for realsies, whereas everything else for the last 30, almost 40 years of my life, it's all been performances in my head. And so I love the way that they're playing Bastion. And I'm very excited to see how this story ends, which I want to talk about in a little bit. Not that I know how it's going to end, but I think I have some ideas on how they might catapult into season two. But before we get into that, I promised you a little bit of a history lesson on this really interesting island called Genosha. Genosha is a huge part of a very big episode of X-Men 97. We've talked about Genosha a couple times now, mostly when I had Jeff Ramsey on and we talked about Grant Morrison's run in the 2000s with all new X-Men or new X-Men. And new X-Men was this leap off point that starts off with a huge extinction event on Genosha that was enacted by Cassandra Nova, his evil sort of twin sister. But that's way down the line of the timeline of Genosha. Let's go back and let's talk about where this island comes from. I think a lot of people might be confused by what this island is because they've played with it in the cartoon a few times. But now it was a big part of X-Men 97, but people might not even know where it's from, what its history is. It is an island nation off the coast of Africa. It's kind of near Madagascar. It's kind of shaped like a moon, the huge island nation. And the main city, Hammer Bay, is that kind of like the inside of the moon crescent. And it is one of those nations that originally seems to be like affluent and prosperous, but which is kind of like in contrast at the time to many other African nations at the time. You got to think of like the 80s and 90s Africa, according to Americans. But it turns out that all of this wealth and prosperity was built on the backs of this enslaved mutant population that are called mutates. Mutates are basically mutants that the government, the human government in Genosha, goes and finds and then does some gene engineering on and takes away like their brain and their memories and makes them a slave. they are kind of handled by this group called the Magistrates, who are some humans, but there are a lot of mutants that have volunteered to be part of the program instead of being turned into mutates. This whole thing is being orchestrated by a very nasty man named Cameron Hodge. I won't go into Cameron Hodge, but the big shift in Genosha happens in this event called Extinction Agenda. It's one of the X-Men stories I really wouldn't recommend to go read. It's kind of, there's some interesting parts of it, but I guess I'll just warn you. It's a little bit of a, it's very wordy. It's a little bit of a slog to get through. Like I said, there's some fun parts in it. The Storm is like, this is when Storm was turned into a young version of Storm, is turned into a mutate as well. But Extinction Agenda happens. This is when the X-Men come and have to like save some of their people that are imprisoned in Genosha. And in the end, the X-Men free themselves. Cameron Hodge is defeated, but can't be defeated because he's immortal, which is a problem that happens in Inferno. And the Magistrates actually take over and free all the mutates and mutants in Genosha. So Genosha is no longer being run by a slave population. But this doesn't solve the problems of Genosha. It actually just causes a lot of civil unrest between the humans and mutants. And there's even like a famine problem. They've got the UN is not really supporting this nation because it's like now it's a mutant problem. It's very much like the civil unrest that America, you know, experienced and continues to experience after abolishing slavery. Just because slavery is gone doesn't mean that those two populations get along. And so goes on for quite a while in Genosha, which leads us to a story called the Magneto War. Basically, after we talked about Fatal Attractions in a previous episode, and at the end of that big story, Magneto is left as a vegetable by a very, very angry Professor X. And so he's off in space getting nursed back to health by like Colossus and the Acolytes. When Magneto goes missing and the arrival of that guy we talked about a couple episodes ago named Joseph, who was the amnesiac young clone of Magneto, he kind of uses all this as cover to lay in waiting and plot a big plan. And his big plan is to rebuild his base in the Arctic. He's had bases everywhere in space, in the Arctic, in the Savage Lands and everything like that. And so he rebuilds his base in the Arctic. He loves being in the Arctic because up in the poles, at the magnetic poles of the Earth, he's the most powerful. And he uses that to create this like kind of spire, this giant tower, the citadel that amplifies his powers and gives him the ability to control, you know, all the magnetic spectrum around Earth, which is why in X-Men 97, in the latest episode, you see him kind of go and do that at the end there. That was a bit of a hint to the Magneto War. In fact, we might be seeing some Magneto War stuff in the final episodes, but it's not going to be able to touch on everything about Magneto War because Magneto War was resolved in a very specific way that can't happen in the cartoon. I'll tell you what that is now. Basically, he was holding the Earth's hostage and wanted to ransom for the means to create a mutant nation. He was tired of, you know, as always, of mutants being persecuted and not having their own place to live. And so he used that as an opportunity to be like, hey, give me the monies and the land to make a mutant nation or I will destroy everything that's electronic in the world. And so this UN representative who was serving as like the mutant ambassador because Professor X was not available at that time. This is during the time when Professor X was still considered human and he was like the mutant ambassador for everybody. And so this woman named Dr. Ada Huxley was put in power to solve the Magneto problem. Well, she had just spent a ton of time in like the Civil War of Genosha. And so she thinks that the way to solve that would be to put Magneto in a position of power and Genosha. And she kind of is able to spin it as a good idea because she convinces the UN that there's so many problems going on in Genosha with the civil unrest and the famine and a bunch of other stuff that it'll keep him so busy that he won't be able to bother humans anymore. And so she gets the approval to give him Genosha and goes even so far as to hide the fact from the UN that Magneto is defeated by the X-Men and depowered because she wants to fully enact her plan. And she shows up and ends the conflict with the X-Men by giving Magneto Genosha. And now he's like a political servant and a political figure and has immunity and all that kind of stuff. And it makes the X-Men very angry. In fact, Wolverine goes, and he tries to go and like do what Wolverine does and like kill Magneto. And Professor X has to put him to sleep to make him not do that. So you can see why the Magneto War can't be something that happens in X-Men 97 because they've already had the Genosian extinction event. But to continue your history lesson of Genosha, while Magneto is in charge of Genosha, it takes him a while to deal with the civil unrest. It takes him a while to gather all of everybody underneath him. The magistrates don't kind of like him. Not all, you know, he basically has to give a ultimatum that all the remaining humans should probably leave. Gives them like a 48-hour notice eventually to get off the island. He's also dealing with the legacy virus, which is ravaging all of the mutants at the time. There's like these legacy virus camps on Genosha. Colossus and Beast are able to cure the legacy virus and all these mutants are cured overnight. This gives him another, this can get into a long history lesson. Long story short, he gets a whole army of mutants now because they don't have legacy virus, tries to do another war against the humans. The X-Men defeat him once again, and this time Wolverine does get to critically wound him, and he is left in kind of a wheelchair to recover. This finally leads us all the way to a prosperous Genosian nation, but a wounded Magneto. But then this is where the extinction event happens, where Cassandra Nova uses that mega sentinel to extinguish what in the cartoon they describe as like thousands and tens of thousands of mutants. In the comics, it's millions. It's millions upon millions. I think the actual number is like something like 16 million mutants are killed in that event. So that's the history of Genosha. And in fact, after the extinction event, there's some stuff that happens on Genosha with Professor X and Magneto, and it leads into the House of M story. But Genosha really hasn't played a big part of Marvel history since then. It played its part in the extinction event with Cassandra Nova. There you go. Just gave you a huge data dump of Bastion and Genosha. Now you know so much about these two entities. You're experts. You're ready to get into these final two episodes of X-Men 97. So now you're ready for my called shot of how I think they're going to jump into season two. I don't know how they're going to end season one. I imagine it's going to be something involving Magneto in the North Pole, Bastion and his Prime Sentinels, and Professor X gathering his X-Men together and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of places that this story could go that while they've touched on so many X-Men events, there's so many still left. And one of them, I think the show is primed to tee up. We have kind of shifted from baddies to Bastion. He's the big bad, the one who's behind it all. But there was somebody that we were talking about a lot in the X-Men 97 stories prior to this. It was Mr. Sinister. And we don't really know what Mr. Sinister's full role is in Operation Zero Tolerance and his collaboration with Bastion. But I'm getting a lot of hints of Fatal Attractions. We've got Cable coming back in time to defeat a major threat. We've got Mr. Sinister working with a larger big baddie for ulterior motives. And the way that Fatal Attractions ends, when Cable is able to defeat his evil clone Strife, we talked about Fatal Attractions in a whole episode, is that he's given a gift that he thinks is the genetic material of like 3,000 years of the Summers and Gray DNA line. But when he opens it, it is the reveal and the release of the legacy virus. And considering how much X-Men 97 is really leaning into the metaphor of the mutants being a placeholder for the other, for being minority groups, for being, people of color or queer people, Legacy Virus being a big part of season two would be awesome, in my opinion. Like I said, when we've talked about the Legacy Virus in the past, it's a contrasting, you know, topic where some people think it's heavy-handed as a metaphor for the AIDS epidemic. I think it's interesting. I think it was a good addition to the X-Men history. And I think considering how well the writers have been handling the X-Men in this cartoon, it could be handled well in a follow-up season. The speech of Cyclops finally being honest with Trish Tilby about no longer not really wanting to play normal for humans, that's awesome. That was wonderfully, eloquently written. Bastion's little speech about how you deal with pesky minorities and how you deal with tolerance. It was just one of the best speeches in X-Men history, and it was in the cartoon. And so I really think that Legacy Virus being the big reveal at the end where Sinister accidentally Pandora boxes it to the world, I'm here for that. I'm making that my called shot. I'm putting it here on the podcast. Now you can go, okay, in about 2 weeks when they do the final episode of the show, and that's the reveal. You'd be like, wow, John's really good at this. He called it. And if I missed the shot, you can be like, you know what? John really tried his best, and I commend him for it. So either way, I need you guys to support me in this. But I'm excited about this show. I'm excited about X-Men. I hope that you guys go read some of these comics. Go check out some of these histories. Read X-Men 100. Go read X-Men, like, I think it's like 14 or 15, where it's like the first Sentinels. They're so silly. I love it. As always, read Nimrod comics. And be good, be kind, be brave. And I will see you guys next time. Thank you so much for joining me for this show. Read more comics. Do it. I said so. And also maybe leave a comment in the Patreon. I'd love to have a discussion on what you guys think of this episode, what you guys think of the cartoon, or join us in the Discord. Anyways, I'm terrible at ending these shows, and I've already done it too long, and I'm sure most of you turned off the podcast at this point. And if you haven't turned off the podcast at this point, thank you. Now you can turn it off. Bye.